Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. This past weekend marked the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare, so I thought today would be a great opportunity to replay one of my all-time favorite morning show conversations with writer Doug Stewart, the author of a fascinating book called The Boy Who Would Be Shakespeare, A Tale of Forgery and Folly. A few years after Shakespeare's death, the British public was insatiably hungry for anything new related to the bard. And it was the perfect moment for a young man by the name of William Henry Ireland, who was anxious to achieve some kind of success that would make his own father proud of him. He ultimately began creating what amounted to a series of perfectly forged documents, which he passed off as having been written by Shakespeare himself. And the public could not get enough of these new documents, new plays and new sonnets. And William Henry Ireland was able to sustain the deceit successfully for some years before it was finally brought to light. Doug Stewart has done remarkable research to bring this incredible story to light. His book, again, published by DaCapo, is called The Boy Who Would Be Shakespeare.
Well, it's actually probably better known in England than here. And at the time this all happened, which was 200 years ago, it was very well publicized. It was actually the sensation of the day. And then it slipped out of view, partly because I think people later wrote about this boy as just a scoundrel who deluded himself into thinking he could write like Shakespeare. But in fact, at the time, he fooled a lot of people. He came a lot closer to getting away with this than people later thought.
And I think that's one of the most interesting things about this story is it kind of takes us inside the mind of someone engaged in forgery. And we can well imagine how this played out for William Henry Ireland, playing out in other examples as well, when people have undertaken forgery of one kind or another. And it is often this sense of audaciousness and overconfidence which ultimately leads them to ruin. We see that playing out again and again, and certainly that's the story here.
Right. Although I think when he started, he was he couldn't have predicted at the age of 19 that what he was about to do would fool much of literary London. He really was focused at first on pleasing and gratifying his father, who happened to be a collector of rare books and manuscripts. And once people started to believe that what he was delivering was authentic, things snowballed.
Right. That's what feeds his passion and audaciousness and ultimately leads all of this to come tumbling down. It's important for us to understand a couple of things for context. And one of them is the circumstances under which William Shakespeare died in 1616. In relative obscurity, which is sort of hard for us to wrap our minds around. Tell us about that. I mean, about his stature at the time of his death and how that in and of itself helps to create this vacuum, this void where one wants to find letters and documents and all kinds of tangible legacy.
That's true. I think it's shocking to us, many of us who aren't English scholars, to learn that Shakespeare did, in fact, die in obscurity. When he was buried, it was actually in an unmarked grave at first. And it was shocking to people 200 years ago also, because in the late 1700s, Shakespeare had become a great hero and almost a god. But in his lifetime, he was one playwright working among many. We talk about him now as the unrivaled bard. He was certainly called unrivaled in the 1700s. During his lifetime, he had plenty of rivals. And by the time he died, his plays were already starting to become out of fashion. And part of this, one of the odd things that people didn't and don't understand is that in his lifetime, the idea of collecting for posterity things that had belonged to a notable person, it wasn't done unless you were a monarch or a saint, you know, collecting the bones of a saint or something. And the idea, the vogue for collecting didn't really gather steam until later in the 18th century. So in his time, people didn't save his papers, for example, and plus he wasn't considered such a notable person. What he was writing, his plays, were passing entertainments. They were ephemera. Hmm. Once a play was set into type and performed, you threw the first draft away or reused the paper for stiffening a bookbinding.
In fact, you mentioned at one point then that when at last the world awakened to the greatness of Shakespeare and the plays began to be gathered and properly published and so on, that in some cases there was almost nothing in the form of a fully complete authentic script, and that they would sometimes even have to resort to speaking with actors who had performed some of these roles years before and have them recount their parts as best they could recall in order for us to reconstruct some of these plays. I mean, it's maddening to think of such a scenario, but there it is with William Shakespeare himself.
Right. There's no way of knowing what he actually wrote because there are no examples of his handwriting except for a few signatures on legal documents. So the first edition, for example, of Hamlet from, I think, 1603, it says, to be or not to be, aye, there's the point. Hmm. Well, that's not the way we remember it, but that is actually the oldest edition. And so there are discrepancies partly because actors remember things differently.
Hmm. Explain how Shakespeare comes to be so greatly revered, particularly by this point in time, in the mid-1790s, not only by this Ireland family, but indeed throughout Great Britain and even in points beyond. Help us understand what fueled this renaissance.
Well, there were a number of factors. One was the growth of literacy during the century, where everybody, well, not everybody, but many people could read. Millions of people in England were able to enjoy Shakespeare through books, and especially through schools. Every school in England was teaching Shakespeare the way they taught the Bible by the 1790s. So people were not only familiar with Shakespeare, but they were taught that he was the greatest writer ever. In Shakespeare's lifetime, probably most people in England were illiterate. Certainly most women were. And if you wanted to enjoy one of his plays, you had to find your way to the playhouse. But more than that, it was a time where England was becoming more powerful. The British Empire now was a globe-spanning force, and it needed an icon that represented the superiority of English culture compared to all other cultures, especially French culture. And Shakespeare was the perfect person.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Doug Stewart. His book is called The Boy Who Would Be Shakespeare, A Tale of Forgery and Folly, and we'll explore William Henry Ireland specifically in just a moment. I want to have us talk about the intriguing title of one of your chapters, The Age of Forgery, in which you lay out all of the ways in which forgery and forged writing in particular were actually quite common in Britain in this period. Explain how forgery was such a familiar part of the landscape, in a sense.
Right. Well, forgery for financial gain had been around for centuries, and Shakespeare wrote about forgery in several of his plays. One thing that was happening, though, with literature in the 1700s is we didn't really have a strong sense of authorship then. Had people publishing plays by people other than Shakespeare and claiming they were Shakespeare. You had novels being published as true stories, Robinson Crusoe, perfect example. And also there were there was just before William Henry, this forger, was born, there was a young man named Thomas Chatterton who had written his own poems in an archaic style on parchment that he found using watered-down ink, and claimed that these were poems from a late medieval monk in England. And people admired them and praised these poems. And later, the young boy drank arsenic and died because he was unable to sell his own writing. Nobody appreciated modern writing. They liked old-fashioned writing. And this boy became a romantic hero to poets like Coleridge and Wordsworth and to William Henry Ireland. He thought, he wrote that he envied Chatterton's fate, and it didn't seem like he'd done anything wrong. He was just backdating his work and writing in an artificially archaic style. The difference is William Henry Ireland chose to imitate Shakespeare rather than a non-existent monk. So it was more of a transgression, certainly.
Right. I'm reminded in the music world, which I know something about, the case of a violinist by the name of Fritz Kreisler, very well known in the early 20th century, who also engaged in composing a number of intriguing miniatures, which he passed off as miniatures which he had discovered that had been composed maybe a century or two earlier, often by composers no one had ever heard of. And he himself had written all of these little pieces, which he would use as encores in his recitals. That would be more like what Chatterton did.
Right.
If Fritz Kreisler had said, I just discovered this long-lost violin concerto by Beethoven, and Kreisler himself had written it, that would be more like what William Henry Ireland tried to do.
Right, or the musician, the pianist who died, and her husband released her greatest hits on CDs, and then a critic put them on his computer, and iTunes labeled them as somebody else's music because it identified them as straight copies that the widower had stolen.
Hmm. One of the things that is interesting about this story of Chatterton and the kinship that William Henry Ireland felt for him. I mean, he wrote it in a letter later, "I would gladly die as he did to achieve such fame." But this also seemed to fuel William Henry Ireland's, what you call, his lifelong disdain for the English literary establishment. Tell us more about that.
Yes, well, to some degree, I think this is a story of a generation gap. He was, Ireland was a young man in the 1790s, and this was the dawn of the Romantic era. And traditionally, to be a writer, and especially a poet, you needed to be an aristocrat, or you needed to have an aristocratic patron. And people like Alexander Pope would write sort of classically influenced poetry that was very witty and followed all kinds of rules. And the Romantic poets that were starting to write then, and the novelists who were starting to write novels, were breaking the old molds. And William Henry Ireland knew that the odds were against him ever becoming a successful writer, because he wasn't particularly wealthy. He didn't have a patron. And that embittered him, as it did Chatterton and many other people. But he just took things to greater lengths to advance his own cause.
You write, "Talent in this era, talent had little to do with it. In England's pantheon of famous writers, a majority had always been men of gentle birth. Few of them ever had to work for a living. Shakespeare, as a commoner who wrote for money, was an anomaly." And so, in a sense, William Henry Ireland was not born with the right sort of connections to make success as a writer likely, and in his view, maybe even possible.
Right, and that's one reason that he and other people admired Shakespeare so much, because Shakespeare was anomalous. He wasn't like the other earls and dukes who were writing plays and poetry.
So we have sort of a confluence of different things. The rising reputation of William Shakespeare, I mean, a fervent devotion to him in many quarters, and this tremendous hunger to have tangible relics from his hand, which don't seem to exist, didn't seem to exist then. It's also, tell us, as we've just been talking, an era in which forgery was something that happened relatively often and people knew something about. And yet it's also an offense which you tell us was a hanging offense, at least certain kinds of forgery. What would prompt this young man, William Henry Ireland, to embark on this crusade is a very personal story involving his father. Tell us a little bit about father and son and their relationship and the pain at the heart of this young man that set him on this course.
Yes, I think when he started, he started small, and I don't think he foresaw what was going to happen. The father was, he saw himself as a gentleman and a connoisseur. He was a collector, and a rather notable collector, at a time when there was a huge vogue for collecting rarities and antiquities. It was how people showed reverence for the past. And the 18th century was a time of great nostalgia for England's past. And his son was a disappointment to the father. He had been a failure in school. The father had sent him to three different schools in London where he'd been completely undistinguished and barely survived. And finally, the father found him a job as an articled clerk, which is an unpaid apprentice, where the father actually paid for a lawyer to take William Henry in to be his apprentice. And the boy knew the father was disappointed, and in his own mind, he was, I think, partly rebellious. He knew he was an intelligent lad, and he knew he was intellectually curious, but he wasn't getting any approval from the adults in his life. So his father often had talked about how much he was dying to own even a signature, even a scrap of paper with Shakespeare's signature. And William Henry heard this over and over and actually tried to look for papers in old curiosity shops that might be signed by Shakespeare. He actually started by looking in his own lawyer's office, who was never around, seeing if there might be some old paperwork like this. And then he decided, partly with Chatterton's example in mind, to take matters into his own hand and make his own Shakespeare memorabilia.
We should maybe say, just ahead of embarking on this road of forgery, that William Henry was someone who was sort of theatrical by nature. You said the stage appealed to his need to escape the dull here and now, and that he was part of a whole family that was theater mad, and really part of a whole culture in which that was tremendously important. You say in his fascination with the stage, William Henry was typical of his time. The theater was the central amusement of 18th century English life.
Yes, that was very much part of the story. First, they lived right at the edge of the London's theater district. They were just a few minutes' walk from the Drury Lane Theater Royal, which was the largest and grandest theater in London. They knew several of the owners of the theater, and actually the family had free entree into the theater. They could watch all the latest plays from the wings if they chose to, which they often did. And it was a time sort of like today where people are all working on screenplays for Hollywood or wanting to. The big ambition in the 1800s, especially the late 1800s, was to write a play. Everyone attended the theater. It was the actors and actresses were celebrities in their own right, in a way that was far different from Shakespeare's time, when women weren't allowed to be acting on stage because it was considered so unseemly, and the theaters tended to be outside the city because, like, bear baiting, it wasn't really a proper activity.
Hmm. You tell us that young William Henry, at the age of 8, had his first experience of having a speaking role in a play. And it turned out to be a tremendously thrilling experience for him. And it's so poignant to think about decades later. You tell us 50 years after the fact, William Henry was reliving the glory of that experience. And I think in telling us about that, about how powerful this was for him, you seem to be suggesting that that also speaks to kind of a hunger which he had for approval, a hunger which went so unsatisfied until he embarked on this trail of forgery.
Yes, very much so. And part of this was the play he was in when he was 8 was an after-dinner entertainment, which to us today would sound like just a very casual amateur theatrical, but actually in those days, having a play in a mansion after dinner, and this was the mansion of Richard Brinsley Sheridan, who controlled the Drury Lane Theater and was a famous playwright in his own right, this was the most prestigious of all kinds of theatrical performances. And he was able to do this because his family was tied into the Sheridans and other people in the theater world. And I think he, as a boy and as a young man, never really understood how he fit in. His father sometimes suggested that he wasn't, that the boy wasn't his natural son. And his mother was nowhere to be seen. Samuel sort of posed as a widower, but in fact his mother was the housekeeper. But she didn't acknowledge that. And so play acting was sort of a natural outlet, I think, where he tried to pretend he was somebody else, somebody better. It was a freeing experience. And then later, trying to write plays, too, he created a whole world in his imagination.
I learned a term I'd never heard before in your book, as you tell us about the young William Henry Ireland amusing himself during school, not with homework or what he should have perhaps been doing, but you say, to amuse himself, the boy would imitate in verse the antiquated language of bygone poets he admired, Chaucer being a particular favorite. And then you say sometimes he indulged in more slavish imitation. Copying word for word the language of an admired writer was a popular method for students in the 18th century to learn penmanship and composition. Making extracts, it was called. That seems like an interesting foretaste of what is to come.
Yeah, it is, although at the time it would not have been considered suspicious. Jane Austen was exactly William Henry Ireland's age. They were both born in the mid-1770s, and in Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen writes about some of the Bennet sisters practicing making extracts. It's like rote learning. It's one way to learn poetry and penmanship, was just to copy your betters. But he definitely took it further than just learning penmanship. It turned out to become an extremely useful talent for a forger.
You've told us that his father, Samuel, was a avid collector of all kinds of things. I was intrigued by how you put it at the start of Chapter 3, the collector of curiosities, when you say Samuel Ireland was an early adherent of the cult of celebrity. I mean, those words just kind of jumped out at me because it sort of underscores how this story, despite the fact that it occurs more than two centuries ago, has some echoes to our present day. Tell us some of the things which Samuel Ireland collected in this adherence to the cult of celebrity.
Right. Well, he had a number of items that had belonged to famous monarchs, Henry VIII and King Louis XVI, and earlier kings. He had a part of a mummy's shroud. He had a garter from, I think, one of the King James's. And this was, again, a way of showing respect for the past, I suppose. But in Samuel Ireland's case, he was especially interested in people that met ghoulish demises, people that had their heads chopped off specifically, like Charles II, Louis XVI, and Anne Boleyn, one of Henry VIII's wives. He had items from each of these people. And at the time, this was still not very common. only in the beginning of the 1800s did this become much more of a popular wave, where you had people, ripping twigs off the trees that had shaded Napoleon's grave, or wanting bits of brandy that had been used to preserve Lord Nelson's body when he was shipped home from Trafalgar. But Shakespeare was one of the first people to enjoy a cult of celebrity. There was a mulberry tree that he allegedly planted during his lifetime that by the mid-1700s in Stratford had almost been killed by souvenir seekers ripping off twigs. And Samuel Ireland had a whole goblet carved of the wood of that tree, or so the person who sold it to him told him.
In fact, you tell us about how a huge gala event had been organized by an Irish-born actor, David Garrick, to celebrate Shakespeare, and that it was a tremendously commercial venture with a large assortment of Shakespeare-themed knickknacks for sale, many of them made of mulberry wood. I mean, that really sounds interesting, too, and again, is sort of an odd precursor to what we so often see today.
Right. Garrick started out, he was the person who really popularized Shakespeare on stage during the 1700s, because Shakespeare's plays had actually been out of fashion for quite a while before Garrick. But then through Garrick's promotion of Shakespeare and staging 10 Shakespeare plays a year at the Drury Lane Theater, it switched over to becoming this sort of Shakespeare mania that swept the British Isles at this time. And there was a whole cottage industry of Shakespeare souvenirs, either plain souvenirs or alleged artifacts from his life, centered at Stratford-upon-Avon, that endured into the 19th century. Washington Irving once said, if you took all the knickknacks carved from Shakespeare's mulberry tree, you could probably build a warship out of the mulberry wood.
What, of course, was of great interest to Samuel Ireland was the hope that he could come into possession of something in Shakespeare's own hand. And he seems to have subscribed to a belief held by many that somewhere in some attic or some basement there had to be a treasure trove of documents and letters and so on that for some reason had been shut away, a treasure trove just waiting to be discovered. A treasure trove which to this day has not been discovered.
Exactly.
And most likely does not exist. Tell us about the first time that William Henry Ireland actually sort of stepped across that line and for the first time forged the name of William Shakespeare.
Well, he had been looking genuinely to find such a thing and failed. And he thought, well, I want to make my father happy, and I also want to impress my father. In part, the boy saw himself, too, as an antiquarian who was good at finding rarities in used bookshops, which he had been doing in his bountiful free time. So he took an old end of a rent roll from probably 200 years earlier, made out of parchment, cut it off, and then using a special brew of ink, he copied out the verbiage on an old deed, and then added Shakespeare's signature and that of another man, along with a reworked wax seal, and presented it to his father as something he just found in the trunk of an anonymous gentleman in London. And he just happened across it, and look, it's a deed with Shakespeare's signature, and what do you think? And his father was not as impressed as the boy thought he was going to be. His first reaction wasn't so much, finally, this is the crowning piece for my collection. His reaction was, where did you find this? And what else is in that trunk?
So it did not generate the, in a sense, the outpouring of affection and gratitude that he was hoping for.
No, and in fact, his father had said that he would trade his collection or half his collection for even a scrap of paper signed by Shakespeare. When his son delivered exactly that, the father offered him one book on how to ride a horse, I think. the vaulting master.
Right, as a gesture of appreciation.
Yeah.
Yeah, you write, Samuel's obsession with Shakespeare was only whetted, not eased, by this first. I mean, particularly when William Henry had described it as coming from a trunk which contained other possible documents with the handwriting and signature of William Shakespeare. Tell us some of the ways in which William Henry, particularly in some of these first forgeries, was very careful with certain difficult kinds of detail. I mean, in terms of exactly how he went about doing this.
Right. Well, certainly using a piece of an old rent roll is pretty careful. And the wax seal, which was quite a difficult thing. He took a seal off a 200-year-old deed and transferred it, softening the wax with candles. And most people wouldn't have bothered. And then later when he was wrapping bundled papers together, the way old bundles would be wrapped, often they were tied with thread. He actually ripped the edge of an old tapestry in the House of Lords when he was visiting one day and stuck the thread in his pocket and then later used that thread to tie the bundles, as though someone had a mass spectrometer who was going to do a carbon analysis of the thread. He would have passed muster. So he was quite careful in some ways.
He, of course, began with this deed, which just had William Shakespeare's signature at the bottom, but essentially none of the words were Shakespeare's own words.
Right.
So he steps into a different direction and embarks on a sort of a different kind of forgery when he begins writing something which is supposedly the words of Shakespeare himself. And oddly enough, it is a profession of religious faith. This is a fascinating thing for this young man to have done. Explain why this was important for him to do.
Right. It's hard, a little hard to understand today because it wouldn't seem so important that here you have a document where Shakespeare is saying, I am a Protestant. But this was hugely important in the 1790s because rumors have been circulating for some time that Shakespeare was a closet Catholic. And there's a tremendous amount of anti-Catholic bias in England in the late 1700s. There'd even been anti-Catholic rioting just about 20 years before, in which a number of people were killed. And this was, in part, it was what William Henry wanted to believe of Shakespeare. He himself was pretty biased about Catholicism. And as each step of the way with his forgeries, he gained new confidence and started taking matters into his own hand and kind of refashioning Shakespeare to be the kind of person that Georgian England wanted to see. So this document, which was the only example anyone had seen of Shakespeare writing in his own words, it wasn't poetry, it was just a declaration with references to the Bible. One reason people believed it is because they were seeing what they wanted to see. They wanted to believe that England's great hero was a good old-fashioned Protestant. And that really helped the boy in his deceptions.
Hmm. You tell us also something really fascinating about the specific words he chose for this document. Choosing many words that would have particular letters in them. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, the only, as I said earlier, the only handwriting anyone has ever seen, to this day, the only handwriting people have seen, are signatures. And there are, I think, 11 or 12 letters in William Shakespeare, or Shakespeare. It's not clear how he spelled his own name. It's one of the many mysteries about Shakespeare. And the W is capital and the S is capital. So when you look at this document, you see a number of capital W's and capital S's, and because at first he was trying to compose using those letters as though people were going to care that much. It turns out people didn't care. They were so delighted to see these documents, they were willing to grant the boy a lot of slack. They sort of looked at the papers. It was parchment or dark paper with watered-down ink, and it was crackled and scorched in places, and people just felt it looked like an old document, and they weren't about to do really careful handwriting analysis.
Right, especially when they so desperately wanted it to be true. So here is this young man trying to put together this document with as many words that have the letters in Shakespeare's name, because he, of course, had that as a very clear template. He knew exactly how William Shakespeare formed those particular letters, the letters we see in his signature. And so this is somebody who's working very, very hard to make this, as in a sense, as persuasive a document, a forgery as possible. And as you suggest, he probably didn't even have to work as hard as he did.
No, and I think he didn't after that first document, because he passed with flying colors. People were just ecstatic to see this document. And after that, even if you look at the sort of internal evidence of the forgeries, if you compare different things Shakespeare supposedly wrote, the handwriting doesn't really match. He was, I think, as he loosened up, Shakespeare loosened up. But again, it wasn't a red flag for people. People were more concerned that the papers had surfaced, and instead of being surprised, the general attitude was, well, it's about time. We were expecting these to turn up.
And of course, in other forgeries as well, there would still be this matter of what you call, in one sense, William Henry correcting Shakespeare's personal biography. For instance, certain forgeries were created to give Shakespeare a certain sort of personality, and in other cases, to demonstrate a great devotion for his wife. Tell us what prompted concerns around things like this.
Well, there are many mysteries about Shakespeare. His biography is pretty much unknown. One of the few things known about his wife is that in his will, Shakespeare left her his second best bed. And sometimes people today make apologies for Shakespeare, saying, well, he didn't really mean that, but it does seem like it was kind of a slap in her direction. And here was this playwright who had created characters like Juliet and Desdemona, and you feel, you know, what was his relationship with women? What was his relationship with his wife? So one of the early forgeries that William Henry made was a love letter to his wife, written when he was still engaged, 17 or 18 years old, and a love poem that begins, "Is there in heaven aught more rare than thou, sweet nymph of Avon fair?" Which is sort of like, roses are red, violets are blue. But I think partly people figured, okay, Shakespeare was young when he wrote that, and he's entitled to a learning curve. But I think one of his early forgeries was to take a printed copy of King Lear and then transcribe it and claim it was a first draft. And in so doing, he changed things. So, for example, he got rid of some of the vulgar jokes that the fool makes, and some of the insults between several characters. It was pretty coarse to Georgian ears. And when he left that out, he also was sort of correcting Shakespeare's taste for the Georgian era, because people who looked at this so-called first draft of King Lear thought and said, oh, now we finally get to see what Shakespeare himself really wrote. And he wouldn't have stooped to using puns and dirty jokes and sexual innuendo. That must have been added by printers later in order to sell copies, or by
or actors. Yes. One of the things that becomes a great problem for William Henry is that, as we've already said, each forgery just made his father Samuel hungry for more, desperate for more. And it became all but impossible for William Henry to keep producing these forgeries, which were supposedly emerging from this mysterious man's trunk. He comes up with a fascinating idea of how he can satisfy his father, and it involves a visit to some of the area bookstores. Tell us about this little chapter in the story.
Yeah, he hadn't really thought these things through. The pressure was a surprise to him. And several people had told him, some of his father's friends who were collectors said, well, wherever Shakespeare's possessions are, there must be all kinds of things, including the books in his library. He must have read a lot of books. So William Henry went around to bookstores right in his own neighborhood where he was known and bought pretty much anything he could find that was about 200 years old or 250 years old. And then he signed Shakespeare's name on the inside cover, or in some cases, if there were histories that mentioned English kings that Shakespeare had written about in his plays, he would underline those sections or put comments in the margin that would hark back to the plays. And he produced more than 100 books like this in short order and delivered them to his father. Booksellers in the neighborhood could have identified them and the boy who had just bought them. But no, nobody blew the whistle. People saw the books and thought, oh, now we have Shakespeare's library. We were looking for that, too, and here it is.
What, of course, is an almost unbelievable challenge he sets for himself, and our listeners can read about this themselves in the chapter called The Lost Masterpiece, is when William Henry promised to his father a brand new play by William Shakespeare that no one had ever seen or even known of. And, of course, he writes later that with my usual impetuosity, I promised this to my father before a single line was really executed. So now came the task of trying to create, out of nothing, an entire unknown Shakespeare play. And, of course, it's just amazing to think about what a challenge that was. And this, too, went largely unchallenged at first, particularly by his father. Just tell our listeners really quickly about the amazing coincidence of a certain painting which was in the Ireland's home. This is a touch of the absurd in all of this.
Right. The subject of the play that he chose to write about was Vortigern and Rowena. Vortigern was a legendary warlord in England in the 5th century. And his father happened to have an engraving of Vortigern and Rowena over the mantle of their study. And visitors all knew about it or could have noticed if they'd looked around. And it's certainly one reason William Henry picked it as a topic. But it didn't. Once again, people just weren't predisposed to being suspicious. They were so delighted. And it was especially hard for the boy to write this play because he was delivering it scene by scene, telling his father that the anonymous gentleman who owned the trunk, who he called Mr. H., was having the play transcribed and couldn't relinquish it all at once. So the boy was just delivering it in a few pages at a time when he was actually writing it himself and didn't even have the benefit of reading what he'd already written because he had to keep giving it to his father. So the whole play was sort of improvised as he went.
Ultimately, as this carries William Henry down this path, he realizes that there's really no easy exit from it. I mean, not only is he nearly killing himself, producing forgery after forgery to satisfy his father, but ultimately he realizes that there's no simple way for this to end with the world recognizing he himself as the writer. I mean, it's kind of like the Spider-Man story where Peter Parker can't reveal to the world that it's he who's responsible for all these heroic deeds. And ultimately, he creates a series of forged letters from this mysterious Mr. H to his own father. And this is one of the most poignant things about the story of all, I think, in which he is trying to stoke in his father feelings of deeper appreciation and admiration for his son by placing in the mouth of this fictitious Mr. H words of praise about himself.
Yeah, I think the real heart of the story is this kind of tortured relationship between father and son. The boy started forging letters from Mr. H to his father to explain to the father why he wasn't going to be granted access to the trunk. He had to trust his son to be going through it and going through it in stages. But as time went on and the father was eagerly reading and corresponding with the non-existent Mr. H, the boy started actually making himself the subject of Mr. H's letters as a third party, saying, "My goodness, you should be proud to have such a wonderful boy. He's so mature and thoughtful. He goes for, he apparently was spending a lot of time at Mr. H's house, where he'd go for walks in the garden and dream about new poems, I guess. And Mr. H even said, and your son has actually embarked on a play in the style of Shakespeare about William the Conqueror. And I must say, I've read the beginning, and it's the best thing I've ever read outside of Shakespeare." But this is the boy writing about himself for his father's benefit.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Ultimately, this, of course, all comes crashing down when some of these works at Samuel's insistence are published and disseminated. And up until now, it was not just Samuel who believed them. Large numbers of people, including some experts, were believing the authenticity of these works. But ultimately, it was revealed without a shadow of a doubt that that in fact these were forgeries. And we can read in your book about how this came to be known. Ultimately, Samuel, of course, and his father suffer quite a rupture from this. William Henry leaves England for a time, ultimately writes about all of this, and ultimately also begins writing things under his own name. Ultimately, where does his reputation end up?
Well, I think it's he has mostly been written about as a pathetic fraud who was very impudent to think that he could imitate Shakespeare, when actually he did a much better job than he's normally given credit for. With his forgeries, he knew Shakespeare pretty well, and what he was doing is recycling bits of Shakespeare's own works.
And you call that play a pastiche of various moments from other Shakespeare plays, just sort of redone a bit.
Right, but people who then read the play and later saw it performed to a standing room only crowd were actually reassured at how familiar so many of the characters and situations were. Vortigern was very much a cross between Hamlet and Macbeth, especially, with bits of other plays thrown in. And instead of thinking, oh, I bet this is all just lifted from Shakespeare, people thought, oh, yes, this is reassuring that it sounds so much like Shakespeare, it must be an early play. And Shakespeare himself recycled things, too. And one thing that I think is people don't really appreciate is forgery is very hard to detect on purely stylistic grounds. We tend to assume that if Shakespeare wrote a play or a sonnet, that his genius is just an intrinsic part of those words. You could just look at it and start reading and know immediately that somebody really special wrote this. When in fact, it's like when you go to a museum, you often will read the wall panel before you look at the painting. People often prefer to be led a little bit. And it was pretty tough to be completely sure that these things were forgeries, even though the most important critic of the time, Edmund Malone, denounced them pretty effectively. Even after he published his expose, people were unsure what to think. Even theater critics
especially,
were not sure.
Especially people who wanted this to be true.
Yeah, and also Samuel Johnson once said that if Shakespeare play was discovered, and this is 20 years before this happened, and was put on stage, it probably would be booed off the stage because people wouldn't want to hear unedited Shakespeare. And they didn't normally see that kind of thing. 1 year before the boy's forged play was staged, the same theater put on King Lear. But it wasn't Shakespeare's King Lear. It was a rewritten version that ended happily with King Lear living happily ever after and Cordelia getting married. And that's the kind of thing that audiences insisted on at the end of the 18th century. So they weren't really sure what they were looking for when they were looking for Shakespeare.
Slippery matter, among many slippery matters in this fascinating story in this book called The Boy Who Would Be Shakespeare, A Tale of Forgery and Folly, published by Doc Oppel Press. Doug Stewart, the author. Doug Stewart, I thank you so much, and I want to remind people of your